Expert Insights with Ladium.
What wisdom is about is how to grow resources inside ourselves. How do we grow strengths inside, like grit or gratitude or confidence, feelings of self-worth? How do we grow those resources inside so we can meet our needs without hitting a panic button?
If you're like most of us, your internal panic button can be triggered far too easily, even on those days which are peppered with simple, pleasant moments. When we enter this red zone, fear, frustration, or feelings of inadequacy can engulf us. You've probably noticed that this state of mind is exhausting and depleting. If you relate, you're not alone. As you'll hear, we all have this hardwired negativity bias, largely due to the evolution of the brain. The welcome news is we can override this outdated mental habit. I'm Sharon Longridge, and I'm delighted to introduce you to our guest, Dr. Rick Hansen. Several years ago, I had the great honour of studying a technique called positive neuroplasticity with Rick. I've found this practice life-changing, and I've shared it with hundreds of people that I've worked with. A psychologist and senior fellow at the Greater Good Science Centre at the University of California, Berkeley, Dr. Rick Hansen is the author of numerous best-selling books, including Hardwiring Happiness, Buddha's Brain, Just One Thing, and most recently, Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength and Happiness, which he wrote with his son, Forrest Hansen. I highly recommend it. As you will hear, Rick merges the latest insights from neuroscience with timeless contemplative wisdom. We start our conversation exploring the evolution of our brilliant and at times challenging brain.
One of the wonderful things is to appreciate what a magnificent piece of equipment it is. And essentially, the brain evolved as the nervous system evolved over 600 million years. That's a long time. And today we have a brain that contains 100 billion neurons, as many neurons in our head as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy, supported by another trillion or so cells inside our brain. And that structure is built essentially in three stages, like the floors of a house from a bottom up. So we have the more or less reptilian brainstem, on top of which sits the more or less mammalian subcortex with things in it like the amygdala or hippocampus that people are hearing about more and more. And then on top of that, the third floor of the house of the brain, the most recent section of the brain, is the neocortex, the more or less primate and especially human part of the brain that's involved in complex thinking, language, and very much used for our relationships. So if you think of the structure of the brain in terms of evolution, it's as if we each have a kind of little lizard, mouse, and monkey, inside our heads. The lizard mainly focused on kind of raw survival and safety, very automatic in its behavior. And then on top of that, we have the mouse very much searching for reward and satisfaction and cheese. And then on top of that, we have the monkey, if you will, the Stone Age person, the caveman, cavewoman, that's very much looking for its tribe, very much looking for a relationship. So to sum it all up, one of the most important ways a person can grow inner strengths is through repeatedly looking for genuine opportunities to experience needs met, to feel safe enough or satisfied enough or connected enough, and then using the power of positive neuroplasticity, wire those experiences into their own brain. In effect, repeatedly, here comes the totally goofy part, repeatedly look for opportunities to pet the lizard, feed the mouse, and hug the monkey.
It's such a great metaphor. And, you know, another really handy metaphor that you bring to your work to help us decode the marvels and mysteries of the mind and brain is that there are two predominant modes in which the brain operates, the responsive mode and the reactive mode. Can you explain for us, please, what you refer to as the green zone and the red zone?
So we have needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. Those don't go away. And the brainstem, the inner lizard, mouse, and monkey don't go away. The only question is, how do we go about meeting our needs? Do we meet our needs on the basis of very primitive fight, flight, freeze systems in which we experience a lot of stress and may need to draw upon those mechanisms to deal with short-term emergencies. But in general, if we go into that, I call it the red zone, the reactive mode, as you said, if we go into that kind of primitive, reactive way of dealing with things, full of fear and anger, frustration, disappointment, resentment, shame, feelings of inadequacy, us against them, conflict, if we solve our problems that way, we create a lot of bigger problems for ourselves and for other people. The other primary way in which the brain and the body function and get their jobs done, you know, to meet our needs, to be safe and to feel safe, to be satisfied and feel satisfied, be connected and feel connected, is in a way that has a sense of calm strength, so that we're still facing challenges. We're not just sitting in a hammock getting our toenails done or having IV chocolate. We're actually dealing with the real world, but on the basis of an underlying sense of feeling strong enough and protected enough in terms of safety, an underlying sense of being already grateful, already glad, already contented in a fundamental way as we pursue our ambitions and our goals, and also feeling already cared about, already of worth to others as we meet our needs in relationship. And the latter is the green zone, the responsive mode. In a lot of ways, what wisdom is about is how to grow resources inside ourselves. How do we grow strengths inside, like grit or gratitude or confidence, feelings of self-worth? How do we grow those resources inside so we can meet our needs without hitting the panic button, or without getting real driven about it, or pushy or obnoxious? And also, at the same time, there are a lot of people who have had their needs really met. They're well-to-do, they're safe, they're the safest generation in the history of the planet, certainly in the developed parts of the world. Great opportunities for satisfaction, pleasure, music on demand, high quality food. The typical person, typical middle class person today eats better than the kings and queens of a generation ago. Just think about that. Medical care and all the rest of that, many opportunities for satisfaction. And also we have many opportunities for connection with others, including through technology. You're in Australia, I'm in California, and we're able to communicate here. So just because we are safe, satisfied, and connected doesn't necessarily mean we feel that way. And if we don't feel safe when we actually are safe, then we start being threatening to others. And we take on board a lot of needless anxiety. And there's similar issues in terms of our other two major needs. So for me, the bottom line here is to use the red zone very judiciously on an as-needed basis. If you need to race into your apartment to get your child's teddy bear and your dissertation tapes for your PhD, in my case, you know, do what you need to do, both the teddy bear and the dissertation tapes. But use the red zone very carefully, because there's a lot of collateral damage that comes with it. And as best you can, again and again, build up those strengths inside so that you can actually deal with your challenges from the green zone and feel peaceful, contented, loved, and loving along the way.
Yet the real challenge that we face is this negativity bias. What can we do about that?
So first, you're exactly right. One of the most robust findings in neuroscience is the negativity bias of the brain, the ways in which it is designed to overlearn from painful experiences, once burned, twice shy, and in comparison, generally not learn that much from beneficial experiences, even though learning from beneficial experiences, and when I say learning, I mean emotional learning, social learning, somatic learning, as well as conceptual learning. Learning from beneficial experiences is the primary pathway to growing the building blocks of inner resources like grit, mindfulness, compassion, determination, commitment to exercise, commitment to justice, and so forth. So what do we do about this tendency from Mother Nature? Thanks, Mom, that we have this brain that is indeed, as you said, like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. That's where positive neuroplasticity comes in. The fact that we have the power every day to help the experiences that we're having have maximum beneficial impact on the brain. If we want to grow anything inside, greater happiness, greater self-worth, more patience, more sense that our own needs matter in our family so that we deserve to actually speak up and have our needs taken care of better, whatever it might be that we want to grow, neurologically, that growth process has two necessary steps. First, we must experience what we want to grow. And then we must turn that experience into some kind of lasting physical change of neural structure and function or function. Otherwise, there's no lasting value. So that's the essence of the process. The good news is that what may sound kind of complicated is actually very simple, natural, quick, private, and usually enjoyable. In the flow of the day, if we have an opportunity to experience something beneficial, a sense of completion, an accomplishment, getting something done, load of laundry, a tricky email, a meeting at work, or if we have a sense of connection with another person, that they're friendly, they're supportive, they're respectful, whatever it might be, we look out the window, we see a flower, our kids make us laugh, our dog is happy to see us when we get home, there's always chocolate, there's always the relief and finally making it to the bathroom. Any one of those is an opportunity to register a beneficial experience and slow it down and then take it into yourself. And a lot of research is showing on studies of human beings. Many college sophomores were sacrificed for science in this regard, but anyway. And then definitely in studies on non-human animals, there's tremendous evidence increasingly that the experiences that we're having, especially with a little help, can leave lasting physical changes behind. And the takeaway for me really goes to the essence of self-reliance. This could all sound very privileged and yuppie and, for upper middle class people in yoga camp. And the truth is two things. One, the worse your life is, the more important it is to grow psychological muscles of various kinds to deal with the life that you've got. The less that the world outside is helping you, the more important it is to grow those resources inside. And the second key takeaway point is that whatever has been true about the past is outside of our control. But where we have opportunity is to help ourselves become the person we want to be in ways large and small. Mostly lots of small ways, a little more patient, a little happier, a little more confident, a little more skillful. We can help ourselves steepen our personal learning curve or personal growth curve as we go forward through the days of our lives. And that steepening of our personal growth curve through positive neuroplasticity and a little bit of skillfulness gets applied to everything. And then we become a person who develops faster, who heals faster, who lets go more quickly, and becomes more able to contribute to others as a result.
What I've absolutely learned from your work and other reading in the areas of neuroscience and the contemplative traditions is what is central to resilience, to lasting inner happiness, contentment, is where we consciously choose to focus our thoughts, where we place our attention. Can you just unpack that? What really has been revealed to me in the work that I do and my own personal journey, from a lot of self-loathing, depression to, I think over the years I've shifted that significantly, is this key realization that we can quality control our thoughts. Can you explore that more deeply, please?
Very touched by what you've said there, just personally right here. And I'm reminded of this sentence written by William James, the American psychologist, who wrote over a century ago, "The education of attention would be the education par excellence." And that's exactly what we're talking about here. To be able to rest attention on what's useful and keep it there, and also to be able to pull attention away from what's not useful and shift it to something that is useful, is absolutely fundamental to functioning, to well-being, and to regulating who we are becoming. Because what we rest attention on is the front end of brain change. Attention is like a spotlight and vacuum cleaner. It illuminates what it rests upon and then sucks that into your brain. Because in the famous saying, neurons that fire together, wire together. So as we pay attention to something, the neural networks and neural processes that underpin that experience of, let's say, anxious rumination, irritable reviewing and reviewing and reviewing of our grievances, let's suppose, or just beating ourselves up with self-criticism, like self-loathing, as you said, again and again. If we fire those neurons together, they gradually wire together. And there's a gradual movement from state to trait. In other words, if we marinate in states that are corrosive to us, like anxiety or shame or resentment or grievance, well, that gradually colors us. That we take on that shade. We take on those qualities. To go the other way, if we are able to sustain attention in our ADD culture to something that's beneficial, whether it's sustained experiences of calm strength or gratitude or feeling connected with other people, then we take those qualities into ourselves. And if you look at the essence in so much research on psychological interventions of various kinds that are quite effective, coaching, psychotherapy, mindfulness training, informal practices, formal practices, and when there's evidence, obviously, of psychological change, that's evidence of neurological change. Otherwise, we're left with magic. We don't yet know exactly what the underlying mechanism of action was, but presumably, if a person is reliably different psychologically, they feel different, they act different, they think in different ways, that means their brain must have changed as well. Well, there's so much research about the power of various interventions, and the essence of those interventions is to help people have states of being, certain thoughts, certain sensations, certain emotions, certain intentions, and then sustain those experiences so they produce some kind of lasting change in the brain. But if people, as you're saying, can't pay attention, can't sustain attention past a handful of seconds, past the duration of a single breath to that experience, their mind is skittering on to the next thing faster before the current good thing has a chance to sink in. That's why mindfulness training is so central, because we have to get control over that spotlight and vacuum cleaner. And the essence of it is autonomy. If we're to be autonomous as independent, individuated beings, we must be able to regulate our attention. Otherwise, we are like puppets, and the primary puppet master lives between our ears, you know, jerking us around from one thing to another.
Most people have a harsh, opinionated inner critic, which reflects the brain's negativity bias. Left unchecked, this critical inner voice can demean us, undermine our work, and sabotage our confidence. I asked Rick how we can dial down this destructive mental tendency.
There are things to do that withdraw power from the inner critic. And that's a general principle. Stuff arises in the mind. The question is, do we add fuel to it? Or do we withdraw fuel from whatever is arising in the mind, the fear, the anxiety, the self-criticism? So one thing to do when the self-critic starts to go is to separate from it. That itself is an enormous step. And observe it, as it were, over there on the stage of awareness in the theater of the mind. It's over there, and you're looking at it, and you're naming it to yourself. Simply naming something, research shows, decreases activity in the kind of activation center of the brain, the amygdala, which is especially oriented around negative stimuli, threat stimuli, what's unpleasant. And so simply just noting to yourself, oh yeah, yet again, the inner critic, yet again, I know you. That alone calms down our reactivity and actually neurologically increases activity in prefrontal regions of the brain that are involved in self-control and seeing the bigger picture and making a good plan. So on one side of the equation, it's to withdraw power from the inner critic by both disidentifying from it and, frankly, ridiculing it a bit. Seeing it as a funny Disney villain character, Simon Legree in a funny hat, or, you know, with big purple glasses. I'm seeing your glasses here, you know, imagining the inner critic with like clown glasses that are like 10 times larger than the ones you're wearing, and something like that. And then the last thing is to ask yourself, what's useful that the inner critic is telling me? All right, what's useful? Think of the inner critic as that annoying person on a committee who usually has a grain of truth in what they say. it's all over the top and they keep repeating their points again and again, but there's something useful in what Bob has to say, let's suppose. And so if we identify and note to ourselves, okay, next time I am going to say it a little differently, or okay, I didn't do that perfectly well, I got it, and I could, you know, do this or that to do a better job next time. Fine. Do you have anything new to say, inner critic? Otherwise, thank you for sharing. Thanks, Bob. But now it's the turn for somebody else to talk. And that's actually a powerful technique to open to what might be useful in what the inner critic is saying and know that you've done that so that at that point, check the box, you can move on. So that's one set of skills for a person to do. And as they do that, those experiences can be internalized. The feeling of separation from the inner critic is an experience that a person can sustain for a breath or two or longer. That's kind of the threshold duration. Call it a breath, a few seconds or longer is usually necessary for something to have a chance of sinking in, unless it's a $1 million moment. So stay with the sense, explore the sense of separation from the inner critic for a breath or two or longer. That will help to stabilize that attitude and stance in you as a new habit. In a sense, we're talking about the formation of good habits. And we're shifting into beneficial traits of various kinds, two ways of saying the same thing. So, in the same way, the sense of humor and a certain derisiveness toward the inner critic, that's too something that we can take in. And also we can take in the general approach and make it more habitual of appreciating what's valuable and what the inner critic is trying to offer, take the help on board, and then move on. That too is something we can internalize in terms of where we increasingly rest as how we are. Okay. More importantly, though, in my experience, it's to grow inner nurturers, because the inner critic, I've been working on this for a while. I still have an inner critic. You know, I did something earlier with the trash can in my home, and the thought arose in my mind, Rick, don't be an idiot. Like, whoa, where'd that voice come from? You know? So the critic, you know, it could take a while. But meanwhile, very rapidly, we can grow inner nurturers. And this is a wonderful kind of practice for people in real life because it feels so good. So one way to grow the internal sense of feeling supported inside, or feeling guided rather than criticized, or feeling that the good in you is seen, or feeling cherished, even if you do make mistakes, building up reservoirs, bulwarks of self-worth that we can draw upon and take refuge in so that we can stand up to and stand against the inner critic. That's a really important thing to do. For many people, the inner critic is kind of like King Kong or Godzilla, this enormous monster. And the inner nurturer is like a tiny fairy godmother out of a Disney film that's about 2 inches tall, saying, don't yell at little Ricky. And, you know, that's way out of balance. So it's really important to grow your various inner nurturers. And so it's useful to differentiate aspects of inner nurturers in ways that I did just a few moments ago. And then look for opportunities to experience that from other people. Experience compassion from other people, kindness from other people, cherishing from other people, respect and valuing from other people, a sense of being with you, loyalty from other people. Any one of those is an opportunity to have and then internalize that experience as the beginning of the process of growing that particular psychological resource inside. And with time and repetition, maybe a few times a day. We're talking here about what's less than 20 seconds at a time, typically. A few minutes a day, be like a sponge, or fill up your inner Mother Hubbard's cupboard with lots and lots of nurturance coming to you from the outside in that then you can draw upon to stand up to the inner critic.